With me now on Fresh Air is painter Jamie Wyeth, whose work has a special significance to Pennsylvania. Jamie Wyeth is the son of painter Andrew Wyeth and the grandson of the great illustrator N.C. Wyeth, who you may know as the illustrator of Treasure Island and Robin Hood, among many other things. Each of these generations have lived in Chadds Ford, Pennsylvania, near the Brandywine. The lush vegetation of Chadds Ford has been the subject of many of Jamie Wyeth's landscape paintings. His summers are spent in Maine, whose rocky, moody landscape has also been the subject of many paintings. Wyeth is also well known for his portraits of people like John Kennedy, Rudolf Nureyev, Andy Warhol, and President Carter. Throughout the year, the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts has been celebrating its 175th anniversary. The Academy is the oldest art museum and art school in America. As the grand finale of this celebration, the Academy is presenting a one-man show of the work of Jamie Wyeth, featuring his oil paintings, watercolors, drawings, and etchings. The show opens on Friday and continues through December 14th. The Academy is on Broad and Cherry Streets. This show continues the Wyeth family relationship to the Academy. N.C. Wyeth exhibited there regularly for about 35 years. Henriette Wyeth was a student there in the 1920s. And in 1966, the Academy presented the first full-scale exhibition of Andrew Wyeth's work. The current Academy show is the most comprehensive exhibition yet assembled of Jamie Wyeth's work. Jamie Wyeth, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Good to be here.
In your family, do you think you could have been anything but a painter?
I think so. I mean, I have a brother who is not a painter, and he certainly ate the same food and sat at the same table. So, sure. I mean, there was no great urgency that one must paint. But if you started painting, you had to be serious about it.
I remember in my neighborhood when I was growing up, some parents would really worry if their son or daughter wanted to be a painter because it was assumed that was a nice hobby to have, but you really couldn't make a living on it. It's the kind of thing you might be discouraged from pursuing professionally. What was it like to grow up in a family where painting was understood and taken seriously and encouraged? What kind of encouragement did you get?
Well, it was just, you know, it'd be strange for me to sort of think if I were in a family where the father put on a suit and left for the day. It was all very natural. I mean, there were paints were all over the floor, canvases. It was a very sort of normal part. I mean, my father worked in the house, so it wasn't a sort of strange thing of going to an office or going to a studio. But the thing you said about people thinking that their children and painting, you know, that's sort of, you know, a hobby. There's a story that my family always told, or my grandfather, that a local farm family came to him in Chadds Ford and wanted to show their young son's work to him. And did he have any potential as a painter? And so they pulled out these paintings, and they were just terrible. And N.C. Wyeth said, you know, he kept trying to see something in them, and he finally realized it really was nothing. So he had to be honest. And he told the mother and father that really he didn't see much future for their son. And their comment was, well, you know, Johnny's a little strange, so he thought the only thing he could be was a painter. So, but that's the standard sort of opinion, I think, of young people going into painting. You know, I think the perception is that.
Did you study with your father at all?
Not really study per se. As I say, paint was all around. I mean, the pencils were there, the tools. There was never any really formal training. I would work. When I would finish a thing, he would look at finished things and make suggestions when up. But, you know, painting is a difficult profession. You can't teach. How can you say a color is a wrong color or a line is the wrong line? There's really nothing. The only thing I think you can teach is discipline, to keep working. I mean, to work. Simple as that.
Was there any advice that he gave you that remains with you?
Well, there's just lots. I mean, there's not one that sort of sticks in my mind. But, I mean, I think probably the biggest influence was just sort of watching him work. I mean, he works, when I say watch, I mean just seeing, he works night from morning till night and is incredibly dedicated. And that was quite remarkable. I mean, he takes painting very seriously, as do I. And it wasn't a hobby or something enjoyable that one does.
Do you feel like you fit into the Wyeth family tradition of painting?
I guess, you know, I feel very strongly that, I mean, that's for the viewer to make that determination. I think the viewer brings that sort of luggage with him, and that's fine. I mean, I'm not going to say, well, how I'm perceived is wrong or right and whatnot. I just paint. I mean, I just do the things, and they can bring their portion to bear on it.
Your father and grandfather were both representational, mm-hmm. and you are a representational realist painter now. Was it ever a possibility for you to do more abstract things, or like when you were a student, when you were studying, did you ever lean in that direction at all?
Well, it's curious how all my paintings really begin as abstractions, and I mean, I personally can say, as far as other painters' work, I prefer abstractions to most representational painting. I mean, I think there's a certain excitement, a certain... But I happen to feel, I mean, my interest in painting is the object, the person, the animal. Why abstract it? I mean, it's limitless to me to work within that form. I mean, if I'm interested in that microphone in front of you, why change the shape of it? Why not sort of work within there? And I think you can go very far. Now, many of my friends are abstractionists, and they feel that their interpretation is much more important. That let's, I mean, yes, the microphone's fascinating, but really nothing comes from that. Let's go to the point of changing the shape of it. Well, that's valid, but for me it's not. I mean, you know, one person likes this and one person dislikes that. So, but again, I'll say everything begins. I mean, if you could walk into my studio when I begin a painting, it's very abstract and paint's thrown, and I mean, my floor is covered with paint stains and whatnot. It's not this thing of sitting down meticulously doing line for line for line.
I remember when I was in college, one of the art teachers gave a friend of mine some advice, and he said, listen, what you need to do for the next 3 years is to just work. Forget your friends, forget your girlfriend, forget everything else that you like to do. Just concentrate on your art. Was it hard for you to be able to do that, since you were in a famous family and probably had and continue to have connections to very important, famous people, and that social life is probably constantly seductive? Was it hard to ever find that...
To work?
That privacy where you could just lock yourself up and work for the years that
not
are necessary?
Not at all, because that's all I do. I mean, I'm really kind of a boring person, and that all I really do is paint, So, I mean, this sort of myth that I, at parties, I think years ago I sort of zoomed around New York a bit, but no, I mean, there was nothing difficult. I mean, I spend most of my time in the studio when I'm working on something, and all those other sort of influences go out the window. I mean, they just don't enter the studio, you know, I don't think one must sort of forget their lover and forget their wives or forget their whatever to paint. But what I think one should throw away is all the sort of preconceptions about how a painting should look, where it should go, what is my philosophy, am I moving in the right direction? I think those are the things that really freeze somebody. I mean, best to just get in there, use all your emotions, throw all those preconceptions away, and paint. Simple as that. Which is difficult many times. I mean, I'm not saying I love going to my studio to work, because really 90% of the time I'm in the studio is not inspired work, but I think you have to push yourself, too. I mean, in an individual profession like that, you've really got to push yourself.
I'll bet that a lot of your contemporaries who are artists harbor a certain amount of resentment towards you, because it's so hard to make a living as a painter. Very few people can really do it. And people are just hustling for grants and hustling for shows. And you had entree into mm-hmm. the gallery and museum world because of your family name and family connections. Do you feel that resentment? Has that been something that you've come up against?
I don't really feel it, but I mean, if I were somebody else, I probably would feel it. I mean, I can understand that and sympathize with it. I do think, however, in the last 20 years, I mean, the climate for a painter has just grown. I mean, the interest, the audience has widened to an incredible degree. But still, granted, I mean, it's tough for most painters, and I absolutely had that entree. Sure, the name and whatnot, and, you know, I can't lose sleep over that, because how can I change it? But I certainly sympathize with, and I, you know, lots of young painters, I'm driving cabs trying to work, but there you are. I mean, that's true in almost any other profession. I think the opportunities certainly are much larger now. I mean, there really is a bigger audience.
How do you feel that your family connection has affected the way critics have felt about your work?
Well, very adversely. I mean, that's the one of the large drawbacks is that, you know, sort of intellectually or critically, I can't be separated from that blob called the Wyeth dynasty, whatever one wants to call it, Brandywine heritage, which is, you know, a bit upsetting to me. But again, as I say, when I go into a studio, all that stuff stays outside. I mean, it really has no effect on what I'm working on right now. And, you know, and you can't change that. I mean, I think, you know, the third generation thing, I mean, it's a catch-all thing, you know, it's something to hang for people to talk about, you know, it's... But, you know, again, there you are. No changing that, you know.
Let's talk about your portraits. There are a number of your portraits hanging in the current show at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. I had read that you went to a hospital morgue to study anatomy.
Mm-hmm. Spent about 6 months doing that, purely out of curiosity. I just was curious, and I knew I was interested in portraits of people and creatures and whatnot. And I'm simply curious, why was this fold there in the skin, or what made the mouth twitch and whatnot? And through several doctors that I knew, they got me into a hospital, and I studied with an anatomist there for a few months, all highly illegal, but it was terrific. And when I say study, it was just, and as this anatomist was so wonderful, he said, really, Jamie, your interest is not the terminology and the function of the bladder and whatnot, but really you should touch these things. I mean, if you're interested in the human body, touch them, get in there, see how they feel under the skin and whatnot, and I'll never forget it. I mean, it's extraordinary. I mean, today when I draw a line of a cheek, I still think of what goes under there making that thing, and that's fascinating. Anything, I mean, I think any subject that you can get deeper into, I mean, it's all the more interesting. The more you know about something, the better it is, at least with painting.
Now, when you're painting a portrait, say, of Nureyev, you're not going to be depicting his bladder. But
well,
you'll know where his bladder would be. What use is that to you in
well,
your painting?
But curious you should pick Nureyev, because, I mean, there it was the one person I've painted who was very concerned with the way I was painting him. I mean, his body, his anatomy, his visage is his life. And he'd never had anybody paint him. He'd never posed for anybody. So every little drawing I did, I mean, if I did something of his toe, he would say, "Niet, you know, that's not my toe. It's more beautiful than that, you know, or this line isn't right." So again, the anatomy lessons, I mean, his body is incredibly sort of articulated. And so, you know, it was of great help there. I mean, I was not allowed to get the anatomy off.
There's something about the way he's posed in your painting that strikes me as being very arrogant, that you caught both his beauty and his arrogance. It's partly his pose, because he's standing there with his hands on his hips. Mm-hmm. It's partly what he's wearing, because he's wearing a beautiful dark fur coat mm-hmm. that's opened, and beneath that is his bare chest mm-hmm. and white tights that reveal every fold and bulge in his body. And he has a beautiful face that seems to be a little bit impatient also. Mm-hmm. At the time of posing, and as I said,
well, he was impatient. I mean, you know what? I mean, he just and in the beginning when I started working with him, he said, "I have no time to pose," you know. And then we finally sort of knew one another better. And then he came and said he would agree to pose. And then it got to be very difficult. So at one point, I was so desperate to get. I'd been doing lots of drawings of him. And then there was a guy in the dance company that I was working with at that point who looked rather like him anatomically. I mean, the figure was rather similar. And so I decided to have this guy come to the studio, and I could at least get the sort of figure down, and then use Nureyev for the thing. So the guy agreed. Well, the next day at the class, I told Nureyev that this is what I was doing. And he flew into this rage and said, "That pig for my body, you know? No, I pose." So it was great, you know, from then on he posed. But, and again, that painting you're talking of, I mean, yes, he's standing there, and a lot of people say, "Well, he's a dancer. Why do you have him standing?" But, I mean, Rudolf Nureyev standing is like a person running to me. I mean, it's just this sort of, as you say, this arrogance, this animal quality. You don't know really if he's a male, a female, an animal. What is it, you know? And he is that way. I mean, it's not a stage persona. He's that way on the ground.
Whose idea was it to have him be wearing the fur coat over white tights?
That was kind of my idea. I mean, he was rather upset by it, but that's a coat that he wears all the time, this sable coat that Saul Hurok gave him or something. You know. And to me, my gosh, what could be more Russian than that? Oddly enough, in that painting, I did endless studies of Nureyev, and I could, for the rest of my life, draw him. He's just extraordinary looking and an amazing person. That portrait, you know, it's a finished portrait, and so often with my portraits, I'll do lots of studies and then do a completed, you know, an oil portrait. Well, many of the studies I did after I did the oil portrait, and many of those studies I think are really closer to Nureyev than that painting, although I think that's one side of him. But you know, with something like that, he's so mercurial, and there's so many, many sides to.
How did he react to the painting?
He seems to like it. I mean, you know, I'm Rudolf Nureyev, and you are nobody, but I mean, but he likes it a lot. You know.
It seems to me, I don't know if you feel this way, that the more you know a person, their face seems to change a little. Mm. The way
sure.
a person's face will look when you first meet them will be changed in the course of a week or a year, the better you get to know them. As a painter who's occupied with people's faces mm-hmm. and bodies, do you feel like you have to get to know someone over a long period of time to understand what their face or body really looks like?
Oh, most of my painting really happens not at the easel, but just being with a person. And when I'm working, on a porch with somebody, I mean, I virtually practically sleep with them. I mean, I just try to spend as much time together as possible. Their voice, everything, I think, goes into sort of doing a portrait. And I think the real distinction also between, let's say, photography and painting with a portrait. I mean, photography is remarkable, but it's the instant. A painting is really a distillation of many moods of the person. I mean, it's your interpretation, of course, but, you know, I mean, you see them one moment and they're furious, the next moment they're joyous, the next moment they're erotic. When all that sort of combines in a painting, or should combine in a painting. And a photograph, it's not, it's the moment, you know, it's the decisive moment. And, you know, I mean, there's just no comparison in my mind. I mean, I'm not a photographer, but that's what excites me about painting portraits.
Let's talk about your portrait of John Kennedy. Now, you spent many hours with him before painting that.
Well, no, not with him. He was dead.
Oh, look, he was dead, of course.
And it was a posthumous portrait in the family, yes. And so so the two brothers posed a very long time for it. And then I spent a month in Washington, sort of 6 hours a day, looking at films, family films of the president, and then official films. Really to kind of establish almost a memory of him, a physical presence. I didn't want to work directly from photographs. And so all those films, that month of films, really added up to maybe if I'd sat with him for a half an hour, just to establish a memory. I mean, as if I'd sort of shook hands. And so I had sort of a memory of what he looked like. And then from that, I was desperate that it would look like a photograph or look dead or something. And so under that painting is a portrait of Edward Kennedy. I mean, really under it. And then I did this one over top. But it's a very curious portrait, and something I'll never do again, a posthumous portrait. And at the time, I mean, it's hard to remember now, but at that point, President Kennedy was just considered a demigod. I mean, you know, this was shortly after his death. This was a subject that you had to treat with. And when I began the portrait, I did this rather glorious thing of him walking. I was swept up in the myth as much as everybody else was. And then I started working with the other brothers and realized that, I mean, great men, but I mean, they're tough politicians. You know, this whole glorified idea was kind of a bunch of crap. And so I destroyed that and then did this portrait, which caused a lot of controversy at the time. People were upset by the portrait.
Let me mention two things that I noticed about it. One, and this has been pointed out by other people too, I'm sure, is that the right eye is floating a little
sort of
bit towards the
bit,
left.
Yeah.
It wanders. I notice, I guess my eye tends to do that too.
That actually was a physical characteristic of the Kennedys, and then I thought it was sort of a mirror of their minds. I mean, Bob Kennedy had it really strongly, and you know, if you talk to him, one eye be looking at you and the other eye be sort of going over your shoulder. And as was his mind, I mean, the conversation would be between you, but then he'd be relating it to a conversation he had earlier with somebody, and how did this fit in with some other thing, and so on. But when that portrait was first reproduced, lots of letters about that, you know, why did you take our president's eye and put it off, and that sort of thing.
Well, another thing is that he's sitting there thinking, and he's obviously not at the point of making a decision. He's at the point of contemplating something, and there's a finger to his lip, or maybe half in his mouth, and I know if I was sitting that way, and a photographer came, like if my mother was around, she'd say, get your hand out of your mouth. It's not supposed to be a way you want to be shown in a portrait. I wonder why you had that finger there.
Well, that came through a lot of films. It was a characteristic of his to sort of raise. He'd take his knuckles and tap his teeth, apparently. It was something that he did all the time when there were not photographers around. Except, and as I say, a lot of these films were films taken by then Mrs. Kennedy and other members of the family. So I thought that was sort of an indication of what, you know, and I thought it represented, you know, my interest in President Kennedy, and I still just tremendously admire him, was that, you know, towards the end of his life particularly, I mean, he was not this young, charging white knight. I mean, he just, the awesome sort of pressures of the world were on his shoulders. He was not very popular at the time. I mean, physically, he was sort of quite tired. And that, I mean, that all is what I wanted in the portrait, and as a consequence, it upset people.
Well, how did it upset the Kennedy family?
Well, his brother, Robert, who, you know, if you remember back then, I mean, he, after the Dallas, he was carrying on the flame and really was the crusader, sort of had devoted his life to his brother and then felt that he should fill out the whole thing. And so I think any sort of thing like that sort of detracted or did not fit into the sort of the thing they were trying to perpetrate. And he felt, I mean, he just told me quite frankly, which at least it was a reaction. He said it reminded him of Jack during the Bay of Pigs. and he felt that was not something that should be perpetrated.
Another portrait that I'd like to discuss with you is your portrait of Andy Warhol. I've seen reprints of the portrait, but today I went to the Academy mm-hmm. and saw the painting itself. And my first reaction was, wow, you painted him like a vampire. His eyes are not only bloodshot, but it looks like there's little pools of blood around them. His face is a study in white and red. His nose is like a red bulbous mass in the middle of his face. There's pock marks and pimples around. I've never met Warhol, and I've never seen him, I don't think, on color TV. So I don't know really what the landscape of his face is like. But how much realism and how much of your impressions is in that portrait?
Well, I hope it's pretty close to him. I mean, he was remarkable in that he let me just study his topography to such a degree. I had a huge Klieg light, but I mean, that's what he does with some of his films. When I saw and he understood it and sat for it. I mean, most people, if they had to sit for that and saw that portrait halfway through, would have said, "Are you kidding me?" and just run out of the studio. But he and of course he at the time did a portrait of me, which is the most glorified thing. I look like some movie star. And of course he asserted that he took all the pimples off of my face and I put them all back onto his face. But Andy does look that way. I mean, that is, if you stare straight at him and whatnot, I think he's wonderful looking, but I mean, I did it as honestly as I could. That's why I don't do commission portraits, by the way, people would not sit for it, I mean, they'd say, get out of here, I'm not going to let you do that, so.
What made you both decide to do portraits of one another?
I don't know why he did, but I mean, I've just always wanted to paint him. I've known him for a long time. To me, he's sort of New York. I mean, he just personifies that whole thing to me, and in a good sense, and in a fascinating, strange, weird sense. And he agreed. He said, "Okay, I'll sit." And so we, I had to have a studio in the factory where his studio, and that's the way it evolved. Now, then he did one of me, but Andy doing a portrait instead of taking a snapshot and blowing it up and silkscreening and whatnot. So.
So you didn't sit for him?
No, I mean, just for Polaroid snapshots,
But he sat for you?
Yeah, for a long time.
What did you talk about when he was sitting?
Oh, just lots of things. Andy, he talks, at times he can roll on. I love, I'm crazy about toys, and he's crazy about toys. So we spent a lot of time going to toy stores and talking about toys and whatnot. So, those sort of things. And then the factory is just a constant parade of every creature you can imagine wanders. I mean, when they hit the island of Manhattan, Warhol is sort of the guru for sort of strangeness or whatever, and they're attracted there like flypaper. And Warhol just sort of wanders through this whole thing, just, "Oh, gee, it's so pretty, isn't it pretty?" he's an interesting person.
He came out to Chad's Ford with you for a while, didn't he?
Yeah.
For I don't know if it was for your.
He comes
portrait
to stays in
his.
The farm. No. He just comes down to visit. He says he comes to the farm because the television reception is better there.
What happens so to him when he goes out into the country?
Sits and watches TV in my house. He does go out. I mean, we'll take walks and whatnot. But I mean, we were walking recently down there, and he looked at the trees and he said, "Gosh, he really preferred the trees in New York because they work so hard in New York that these trees don't have to work very hard down here." So he's a truly urban person. I mean, he just loves New York, and that's his. When we first started working in New York, I've got to be outside at certain times. I just go crazy about just sitting inside. So I finally convinced him we had to go walk. The deal we struck was that we would walk, but we walked in subways underneath the streets, rather than on the streets.
It sounds like a vampire. Is afraid that if the sun comes out.
Well, no, but that's where his work is, though. So it's understandable. It's not that he's being cute and amusing. I mean, that's his real world, and that's what he drives his books and his films from and whatnot. So it's not a gimmick by any stretch of imagination. He's a very hard worker, as much as he says he doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Now, you live in Chad's Ford in mm-hmm. Maine and sometimes in New York, mm-hmm. three really different mm-hmm. environments, and you've painted mostly Maine and Chad's Ford. I don't know that you have any New York paintings.
Well, almost all the portraits are in New York. The Nureyev portrait was done there. I don't paint New York because I'd happen to have not been born in a city or born in, I mean, I'm sure if I had been born in New York or Philadelphia, I'd be painting the streets and whatnot. I mean, that's what always irritates me when people say, "Well, how can you paint country because it doesn't exist anymore?" Well, it does exist, and I happen to have been born in the country. And I think one paints what they know best. And it would be lying for me to paint a city. I work in New York just because it's studio space and it's simpler. I mean, with Nureyev, who's dancing all the time, with Warhol, that's where his work is. You know, these etchings that I've been doing, it was simpler to do them there. The Germans that were working with me came from Munich to New York, so that's why they're, you know, the two places.
What are some of the things that interest you most about Chats Ford as a painter?
Not much, really. I mean, I just, landscapes really don't interest me that much. I don't know, I mean, if you've noticed in the show, they're more sort of objects than sort of rolling fields and farmhouses and whatnot.
Sure, I know what you mean. It's more of the details, a stump of a tree,
yeah,
the grass.
But they're all
the
just familiar things of mine. I mean, they're all things that I've known for a long time. I mean, the objects that I paint are not something that, you know, if somebody comes to me and says, oh, Jamie, I saw a great tree yesterday that you'd love to paint. Well, nothing bores me more than great trees to paint. Or I saw a wonderful face. Well, I'm not interested in noses and eyeballs and interesting faces. I'm just interested in things that I've known for a long time and to try to sort of translate them in some way. And it so happens that the things that I know happen to be farm things or something, purely because I live on a farm, working farm.
And in Maine, you have a very contrasting
Maine's
set of familiar
thing.
Things around you. You have rocks and ocean instead of trees and grasses.
Right. Very small island and a bit of a different environment, but and interesting in a sort of a microcosm. I mean, it's a very small island, and you can barely see the mainland from the island, and, you know, it's fascinating. I love that, too. It's great.
We talked a little bit about your portraits. Something that you've done that's similar to but different than portraits is paintings of animals. You have about 4 pig paintings, maybe more than that, in the Academy show: Portrait of Pig, Winter Pig, Night Pigs, Pig in the Train. Why pigs? What interested you in these pigs?
I don't know. I'm sort of embarrassed about it because it's become such a gimmicky thing, piggies and Miss Piggy and all that sort of stuff. I just happen to have known pigs. I mean, they you know, I've had pigs on the farm, and I've just started drawing them years ago and like them a lot, and they're bright, intelligent, moody, mean animals. And but it just makes me shudder when I see this sort of love of piggies now, because the piggies they're talking about bear no relation to the living creature. They're kind of Walt Disney-esque sort of things. I hope the paintings you mentioned there, that when people see them, they're not, you know, that they look at them as real living creatures. And I really view those as portraits, too. I mean, the things I've done of the animals and even of the objects I view as a portrait and not a scene. And because I spend as much time with, I mean, a pig in these cases as I do with a person painting. I mean, you really, I mean, daily sort of working with them. I mean, you get that sort of close to an animal. I mean, you forget that there are no words going back and forth. I mean, you get eye contact with an animal and really look, and the animal's really tuning into you. I mean, it's fantastic. I mean, it's as deep as any conversation you'll have with any human being, I think. I mean, that's just sort of excites me.
You can't convince an animal to pose for you, to sit still.
They
while you're
can sort of, yes, they sense. I mean, and I particularly pigs. I mean, they really will sense or pose, you know, and get into a situation. God knows how. Maybe it's just my weird mind, and I think they do, but I mean, somehow they pose, you know, thus these paintings.
I know, I'm trying to think of which, maybe it's Portrait of Pig, but one of the first things that caught my eye looking at it was the nipples on the pig, and I figure if you were doing a cute little pig that you would have left stuff like that out, the really red snout.
Exactly, and I wanted to, I mean, I felt, gosh, if I was going to do a definitive portrait of a pig, or at least my interpretation of one, it could not be undersized. It had to be life-size, and I wanted every hair on it. And I think there are a few of the drawings in the show, but I measured her. I mean, I measured her ear, her eye, and everything. Just now, God knows why. I mean, obviously, I went a little overboard, but there you are. I mean, the painting's there, and, you know, it is a bit odd, I suppose. But
how do you feel about your self-portrait that's in the show, Pumpkinhead, where it's a portrait of your body with a pumpkin?
Well, that was just, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I got sort of strange and interested in sort of, I at the time I was supposed to do a portrait for a self-portrait for a National Academy, of which I'd been appointed some member or something, and then I kept drawing myself and I was so bored with that, and then I one night I was actually was in the island of Maine, I put a pumpkin on my head and walked around the house and caught myself in the mirror and went on, and that's so sort of fascinating, this sort of a vegetable on top of a human form, you know, why not? I mean, it's sort of hell of a lot more interesting in my face. So thus came Pumpkinhead. Now, I don't know. I mean, there's a recent article. They had some psychiatrist sort of looked into it as to what my motivations were. Now, I don't know. Maybe I had some deep-seated motivations, but I just got very excited for a month. Felt that was the most exciting painting that I could have ever done. Now I look at it and think it is a bit odd, but.
Do people usually try to psychoanalyze you or decide what kind of person you are through looking at your work?
Oh, yeah, and I'm fascinated hearing what they have to say.
What are some more interesting things, true or false, that have been said about you?
I don't think they're for air, you know. But they're just all sorts of, people have their curious motivations. And again, I'm not going to discredit that. I mean, I think that if that is their sort of what they get out of it, then gosh, maybe they're right, you know. You know, I mean, there are the paintings to look at it, and I think the paintings speak for themselves. I mean, it's very rare that I sit in front of a microphone talking because if I could do that, I wouldn't paint. And I think people get their own opinions.
You went to the Soviet Union not too long ago. What year was that?
Gosh, I think 3 years ago or something like that, 3 or 4 years ago.
And I understand that you met some of the dissidents there. What was your... how much did you find out about Soviet art or why there's so much discomfort and fear of abstract art?
It's a curious thing. I don't know. You know, the first curious thing was if Soviet literature or Russian literature, Russian music, whatnot. I mean, there's some great, great musicians, great writers and whatnot. Well, name one great Russian painter. There aren't any great Russian painters. I mean, Chagall, Kandinsky all did their best work out of Russia. That was the first interesting thing to me. Second, the Soviets, the official line, they love the Wyeth paintings. I mean, you know, because that's the official line of painting is social realism. So I think they invited me thinking I was the young Wyeth, that I would go over there and say, this work you're doing is so wonderful. Well, it's just sheer crap. I've never seen worse stuff of women manning the barricades of Leningrad. Interesting one sort of poster sense, but really terrible. On the other hand, you have the sort of dissident, they call them, or unofficials, doing paintings which are non-objective and whatnot, and are fascinating. I mean, at least there's a little excitement, a little life there. I mean, they're very derivative. They have their Rauschenberg, and they have their Warhol imitator and whatnot, and it's rather structured, and they do not badly, really, by selling to foreigners and whatnot, sort of under the table, so to speak. But the official Soviet thing, and I had made it very clear to my post, the Union of Writers and Painters, which invited me there, that I wanted to see all forms of Soviet painting. And so they let me do it. They didn't prevent me from doing it. I would do this at night, sort of, and whatnot. And then at the meetings, we had endless meetings every day. And finally, towards the end, I just got sort of irritated and said to the head of the union that, you know, why, I can see how you suppress writers and whatnot, but painters, they don't shoot at you and whatnot. What's wrong with those? And, of course, he said, you know, well, that's dirt. You know, never underestimate the power of those paintings. They're dirt. They're corruptive, you know. And I think it's the mentality that if you can't understand it visually or instantly, then it's suspect. You know, there's something... You know, their whole line was, well, it's depressing. It's not uplifting, that sort of painting. Well, you know, then I would say, well, you take some of your great writers, Chekhov and these people, you can't say those are the lightest sort of wonderful whistle through the wind sort of reading. And they say, oh, but that was a long time ago, you know. That's all right. I mean, once it's gone, it's okay. But it's a curious situation over there.
What kind of function do you think that your art plays in the role of the people who know and appreciate your painting?
What sort of function? I don't know. I think, you know, that back to the Soviet thing, the one fascinating thing about the Soviet Union vis-a-vis the United States in terms of painting is that they view here painting is considered recreation, you know. I mean, we'll support the arts if there's a little money left over and whatnot. In the Soviet Union, I mean, if you are an official artist, you are a national hero. In the same token, if you're not official, you're a criminal and whatnot. That's kind of fascinating. I mean, painting is taken very seriously. Here it's not. It's for fun. You know, it's after you've had work, after you've done that. Oh, well, let's maybe go see an exhibit. That's changing, I think, a bit now, but that is the case.
Well, Jamie, we're almost out of time, but I'm sure you've walked around your show at the Academy and have seen, your life flash before you in a way, because there's paintings from... the whole time you've been painting, just about. What's it like for you to be in the middle of all those paintings?
Sheer horror, I can't tell you. I'm not being cute. I'm absolutely being serious. I've never endured anything so terrifying. Because there they are. It's not like a writer with his books where people aren't reading it in front of you. There they are. They're right there. All your mistakes, all your things, you know. Oof. Don't like it. But I hope you'll go see it.
I'm sure everyone else will feel differently when they're in the show. Jamie Wyeth, thanks so much for speaking with us this afternoon on Fresh Air. It's been really interesting
to
have
you
here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Been speaking with painter Jamie Wyeth, and his one-man show will be opening Friday at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. The Academy's on Broad and Cherry Streets, and this is basically the grand finale of their 175th anniversary celebration. So the show will open this Friday and will continue through December 14th.